Frank, it's a pleasure to speak with you over the air. We got to speak in person in Havana. That was nice.
Yeah, Don, it's really it's great to be talking with you again. This time I'm in Mexico City, and I, as you mentioned, I met you in Cuba at a pretty amazing moment.
And with Errol Maitland, and you recognizing his voice before he finished saying his name, and you guys had been working on the air, over the phone for years.
Yeah, it's really, really good to meet him in person, both you guys. So, yeah, I'm really glad to be on your program today.
And it's our pleasure to have you. So, what was your first? Was that your first trip to Havana? That was my first trip to Havana. It wasn't Errol's first trip.
Yes, it was absolutely my first visit. I live in Mexico. So many Americans and Mexicans have traveled from here to Havana, Cuba. Mm-hmm. There are so many flights that are available, an increasing number, way before the United States opened up. Mexico was offering this, as many listeners know, and probably have actually made that journey. But it was my first time, so it was quite eye-opening, quite a moment to see Cuba, really.
What did you see? And I guess our listeners should know, you're an American and you're living in Mexico City. You were born in Arizona, is that right?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, I'm from a Latino background, Mexican-American, But what we know about Cuba is what most of the world does, which is, I would say, not much, right?
Right. But
from the glimpse I got there, we were there about a little bit over a week. Mm. And I'll just walk you through the process. I mean,
sure.
I was in my living room right here in Mexico City, where I'm speaking to you from now, when we got the news of Fidel Castro's death. It was about 11 p.m. local time, probably around midnight New York time. Mm-hmm. And being a journalist, the first thing I thought is, I need to be there. I need to witness that.
Right.
So we sent a request to our offices in Beijing. I work for a Chinese global television company here covering Latin America in the English language for global viewers. And so we got the green light, amazingly enough. I'm sure every journalist in Latin America wanted to do that story, but we got lucky. The channel I work for does have a correspondent in Havana, Cuba, and he's a very seasoned veteran there. So he needed to get some backup. We were sent in. And the process goes like this. To do that, you need to have a journalist visa. It's like pretty much any other country in the world. I mean, yeah. Mexico requires a journalist visa, though lots of people who come to report don't always get one. But so to get into Cuba, we needed to get a journalist visa. We made the application Saturday morning. And my producer was a bit frustrated when we didn't get it right away later that Saturday to be able to get a jet and fly to Havana on Saturday.
Yeah, well, the whole planet was probably applying, too. I mean, this was big news.
I think so.
Yeah, yeah.
We got the visa the next day, and we were on our way to Havana. So it was, I would say, it was quite a speedy process. And I didn't feel, upon arrival, some kind of government agent hovering over my head.
Yeah, right.
So I imagine, they knew we were there. I mean, we had television equipment, so...
And my experience, actually, I was planning to go. We had booked the flight and everything to go as people. You can't go as a tourist from the United States under U.S. law still, as part of the sanctions regime. But you can go. This is, I guess, one of the innovations or, the new policies of the Obama administration. You can go on a people-to-people exchange. So that's how we went, planning to go to the beach, to restaurants, to bars, to hear music in the street, etc. Everything a tourist would do that's not a tourist. And then I heard, and we'd booked that a month or so in advance of when Fidel Castro passed. And you're telling me what time that was. I hadn't really looked at it. All I know is I started getting contacted by some foreign media, Russia and Iran and some others, at about 12:15, and now I understand that they were like jumping on the gun.
Yeah. The word really started to spread very quickly across Latin America. And then I realized it was across the world.
Yeah.
I was getting messages from journalist friends in Africa asking me if I was going to be covering the story.
Right.
And we still had no idea. It was still overnight here in Mexico City. We were waiting for the word. But we were able to land and got established. We ended up staying in the home, a person's private home. And as you know, the government has been allowing Cuban citizens in certain parts of the city of Havana perhaps it's the rest of the country. I couldn't say. I only saw Havana and outlying areas. And we basically stayed in a woman's home. The cost was $45 a night on Latin American hotel scale. That's very inexpensive.
Yes.
In the city of Havana that night, I was told there was a hotel half a block from us, the famous National Hotel in Havana, and rooms there were going for over $100 a night as high season tourism started to approach. We were just days away from the arrival of all the tourists, and you were among them.
That's right. Yeah, I was going there because it's warm and it's starting to get cold up here in New York. You know,
yeah, it's definitely nice and warm, and I had I had the experience that I suppose it would be a wonderful place to be a tourist. We were there as journalists and we got busy. The channel put us to work right away. We were out in the streets the very next morning. We went to the very famous Plaza of the Revolution. And this is the plaza that you see where you see buildings that have the face image of Che Guevara, of Camilo Cienfuegos, who was also one of the revolutionary heroes, and of course, Fidel Castro. There's also a giant statue of Jose Marti flying under the Cuban flag there. So what we saw, as you know, and you were there, we saw a monument in the middle toward the center area of the square, and then three extremely long lines that lasted at least two complete days of people just constantly streaming in to pay their respects.
Yeah, the whole country. And the task that you guys had to cover it also was spread across the country, because you're in Havana. The final events for the memorial service took place on the other side of the island in Santiago de Cuba. And so you had people there. You had the feed there. As a matter of fact, you were gracious enough to let us watch the feed with you in your studio there, in the studio in the hotel. And, you know, you had people in the streets covering. You have a group of pieces that you've shared with me that feature you, for example. You want to talk about those a little bit?
Sure. Well, it was a series of six television reports that we did on Daily Deadline. Each of those six was produced on the day that it was broadcast. And it was basically starting on that Monday after we landed, a couple of days after Fidel Castro's death was announced to the world. And the very first story was that story about being in the Plaza of the Revolution. And just, we wanted to just ask people, what are you really feeling? You know, we wanted to try to find a few people that, you know, that didn't have any sense of, you know, being controlled by somebody or standing near a security guard, so that they might feel free to talk to us. If you can do that to a television camera, I think it's often a difficult thing to do, a big TV camera looking at you. So we spoke with a woman and a man, and they both explained to us the tears in their eyes, because they were actually quite deeply moved by the death of Fidel Castro. Right. I got the sense that you just can't fake that, you know. That's got to be authentic, deep sorrow at the loss of this man's life. And people knew he was going to die. I mean, he was 90 years old when he died, so it was not a surprise. But it was a bit surprising to me to see how much he was really, I think, genuinely well loved. So that was the first story that we did, kind of a look at the day of homage there in the Place of the Revolution, and just people streaming in, and, you know, a very solemn moment for Cuba.
You know, let's play a clip. There was a woman inside your piece that particularly moved me, that spoke about how the revolution was responsible for her being an engineer and for her having a family, like, in some details. We're going to play that right now.
Yo soy ingeniera.
I'm an engineer thanks to this revolution. I have a family. This revolution has given me everything.
So, yeah, that was pretty moving.
Yeah, she really convinced me that it was because of the socialist system in her nation that she was able to move out of poverty and get herself a university degree, and then eventually become, as she said, an engineer. And she said it was absolutely because of the system that was installed following the Cuban Revolution. She absolutely believed that was the case. And I said, you know, couldn't you have done it on your own? When we were off camera, I asked her, you know, couldn't you have, you know, found a way to pay for your education? And she just said, you know, we're a very poor family. There's no way I could have done it. It would have never happened. So She was one of two people in that story. And the other fellow also said something like, you know, I asked him, what does Fidel Castro mean to Cubans? And he said,
como un padre. No solamente para mí, un padre también para Cuba.
He was like a father for Cuba and for Latin American countries, and he was a symbol of just causes. That was the importance of his legacy.
I think he said that in a very genuine kind of way as well. So I got the sense that the people able to see in the areas that we moved in those very few days I was there, did seem genuinely moved by his death.
Not the evil dictator finally, you know, the wicked witch finally passing or whatever, which is how it's portrayed here. You know, when Raul Castro spoke in Havana at the head end of the 9-day memorial, he recited a number of things. He essentially ran through a quick history of the revolution in Cuba as it unfolded from even before January 1st, 1989. But then he spoke about some things that happened in the first 3 years of the revolution, including eradicating illiteracy, which would be foundational to the kind of uplift that this woman was describing as a product of the revolution.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should say, I mentioned that I was staying in someone's personal home. Doña Isabel, her next door neighbor, they have a passageway that connects their two kitchens, these two ladies. It's amazing. Oh, cool. So you can actually walk through the passageway and you're in the neighbor's home, Doña Conchita. Doña Conchita was a little older. The woman I stayed with, Doña Isabella, was about in her 60s. Doña Conchita was 75 years old. Mm-hmm. And she explained to me that she was on some of those first brigades in the early 1960s, right, following the Cuban Revolution and the change of regime there, mm-hmm, the change of government. Fidel Castro invited a lot of young people to join up and go to some of the highland areas and the mountainous areas where he launched the revolution in the eastern part of the country near Santiago de Cuba. Mm-hmm. That's where Castro, as you know, was buried. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of these young people's brigades in the early 1960s made their way to these mountains and worked with some of the poorest people in Latin America to bring literacy. And this woman recalls the details of that experience. And you know, we had several days to sit with her, and, you know, at no point did I feel somebody's telling this woman what to say, though she was very, very much in favor of the Cuban Revolution and spoke with, you know, a lot of pride about it. But she explained that, you know, of all the things that she could have told us about her life, she spent a good amount of time talking about that trip to the literacy campaigns. And I thought, what an interesting thing, because usually we think about the people who are hopefully the beneficiaries of such a social change brought by certain governments around the world when they decide to try to do something for the poorest of the poor. But I often forget about the people who are delivering the service. What is it like for them?
That's right.
And this, you know, from the perspective of this woman at the time, a very young woman, I think it enthralled her about the idea of the kind of changes that could take place.
Yeah, it's a very personal experience for the people involved. You know, one of the things that that's interesting about it is that that same model is what's been applied to essentially a global delivery of healthcare services, whether in terms of training, construction of infrastructure, building a capacity to produce pharmaceuticals, etc., that Cuba has used with medicine towards the world.
Cuba definitely has that reputation here in neighboring Mexico. For example, I know a number of people who have gone for surgeries there, partly because it's a cost issue. I mean, you can get pretty decent health care, even surgeries at a fairly, you know, inexpensive a cost for patients from outside of the country. So you'll hear stories of people from Latin America traveling, but there's also, of course, many stories of people who've come from around the world. Now, I should tell you, the glimpse that I got at Cuba was contained to the capital, Havana. Right. So we never got a chance to go actually into a healthcare unit there or a hospital. That was going to take a little bit more time. You have to get clearance from the hospital itself, and of course from the government. So we never got to actually lay eyes on those kinds of settings. After leaving Cuba, I had some people tell me that they had seen hospitals with scarcity of medication, scarcity of simple things like gauze and band-aids and things that you need, bandages. I wasn't able to verify any of that sort of thing, but I did see a thinner population. Mexico, of course, where I live, is a place that's sort of starting to reflect U.S. styles of eating in the last couple of decades under NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. So you're seeing a lot of obesity here in Mexico. In Cuba, I just didn't see that. I saw what seemed to be very healthy people. So.
Yeah.
You know, again, anecdotes of a journalist who had a few days to see an amazing place.
You know, the Cuban government itself has argued at the UN and elsewhere that they do suffer from these shortages and that they're a direct consequence of the embargo against their country by the United States. So, I assume that that is true. In terms of anecdotal information, as it turns out, Errol is married to a woman who is an American, the daughter of two American MDs, who went to med school in Havana. She was trained in Cuba, and she now practices in Brooklyn. And one of the interesting things about it is that if you go to med school in Cuba, the government pays for it, but they make you invest a few years of your time delivering health care to people that need it and can't afford it wherever you're going.
Sounds like a pretty wise deal to me. And, you know, they turn out some top-notch doctors. Look, she's there practicing now in New York City. And that's not an easy thing to do. You've got to be able to really pass those exams as well. So she was able to do that. And she had the background, the training. I saw a lot of high quality in Cuba. I got the sense that there's a lot of attention to detail. And I saw strong infrastructure in the capital. I saw good roads, good bridges. Yep. Walking along the Malecón, the famous walkway there, looking out to the sea that separates Cuba from Florida. It's a beautiful area to walk along.
Definitely.
And quite safe. I got that feeling. I was walking around pretty much at all hours of the day and night, and I felt absolutely safe there.
Me too. Let's talk about some of the things that we saw in terms of the economy. You did a piece, The Cuban Economy Under Raul Castro, and there has been a change in direction, some more private activity. You want to talk about what you saw and what you discussed with people about that?
Yes, I was given an interesting assignment to try to show the difference, because it's television. You got to show it to viewers. What has possibly changed in the 10 years that Raul Castro has been the president of Cuba? So it's been a full decade now that Fidel has no longer been in charge. So we were asked to go out and look at that. So one of the first things I do, of course, is turn to Doña Isabel, right where I'm staying. Mm-hmm. I mean, she became a sort of source for a lot of things. And we just asked that question, like, where would I go to actually see the difference? And she said, oh, you know, in her Cuban accent, Chico, it's pretty much everywhere you look, you know? and I said, she said, you're sitting in one of them right now.
Yeah, right.
She said that the government has been allowing an increasing number of Cubans to rent parts of their homes and make an income that way and earn that Cuban monetary unit called the CUC, the cook. And it's a good way to earn a living. And she said, you know, you could start to see that sort of thing expanding quite a bit in the last 5 to 7 years. And of course, it began well before that. There were also these things called paladares, which are those restaurants also oftentimes in people's homes. You would see more of those. Yeah. And there's also, I saw quite a mixture of private enterprises mixing with state-run enterprises, but also absolutely enterprises that used to be absolutely state-run are now run by individuals, by private organizations.
Yeah, and so, cooperatives too. I noticed the buses were Cuba Cooperativo or something, and it seemed like a cooperative owned a good number of a good part of the bus fleet.
Right, and a pretty sharp-looking bus fleet from what
I
saw.
Yeah.
We saw some vehicles that were brought in recently from China. They're brand new. So
those are impressive buses too.
So I don't know. You know, in the sector where we were, they call it the tourism area.
Right.
It's a number of large neighborhoods.
Right.
We saw the famous old antique cars from the right. 40s and 50s.
Right.
That's also something that you're seeing more and more of. And one foreigner that we spoke with has a business there, driving people around in a fancy 1952 Bel Air. Really nice car.
Yes.
And he says he invested 50,000 US there in Cuba, got the
the
go-ahead from the Cuban government to do that, and now he has a business there in Havana. And so you have Canadian citizens doing private business there.
Right. And we saw also some of those restaurants where they were placed in what probably was the community room or one of the first floor apartments in apartment buildings. So what would be in New York City, say, you know, an apartment building sitting on top of the first floor retail or commercial, suddenly some of these apartment buildings that are, you know, clearly publicly owned apartment buildings using a part of the space to run one of these businesses out of, that are catering, a lot of them are catering to tourists only, but you can see the potential that they're building an infrastructure for them to be able to cater to, and in some cases already catering to Cubans as well.
That's right. And one of the really sharp analysts that we spoke with there in Havana told us that you do definitely see a mixture now. You see companies and sectors of the economy that are absolutely state-run and continue to be, and that probably won't change. And we saw a lot of elderly and young Cubans who told us in Havana that they'd like to see it stay that way.
Yep.
They're happy with it. And then there's a middle ground area where you see mixtures of private organizations, private companies, or these collectives working with the government, and those are enterprises. And then you'll see those things that I mentioned that are absolutely private, and so privately run businesses. And so these were the kinds of things that we were able to show in that story.
Yeah. And I'm curious, you also spoke with one of the revolutionaries, you know, original revolutionaries in Cuba.
I think you're making a reference to a guy who's famously known in Cuba as El Cuate, Antonio Del Conde. He's going to be 91 years old on January 5th.
It's Fidel's age. Yeah, Fidel's age.
Yeah, he was proud to say that he was 8 months older than Fidel Castro. and this gentlemen, we actually met him here in Mexico City. I didn't know this part of the history of the Cuban Revolution, but a lot of it began in Mexico. Fidel Castro met Che Guevara in Mexico City.
That's right.
And they planned a lot of you know, what would be the early attack here from Mexico. They were also, they did military style training. They were able to get firearms. And partly they got those from this man known as El Cuate, El Conde, Antonio Del Conde. And so he explained to us his feelings on going back. This is the man, by the way, who made history by giving Fidel Castro, or basically selling it to him at a low cost, the yacht, that famous yacht called the Granma. That brought the Cuban revolutionaries to eastern Cuba that initially sparked off the Cuban Revolution. So that boat, of course, the yacht, is enshrined in Cuba's most important museum.
And it was closed when Errol and I got there, just like every other museum we went to. We just seemed to miss the schedule every time we went somewhere.
Yeah, they were actually remodeling it, and I think this week opening it up again.
Right.
And so you can actually go in Havana and go see that yacht. And so we filmed an interview with him there and just spoke to him about what it's like to come back from Mexico to Cuba. So this is a man who's all his life as a young adult and all the way through his years, the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, right? This guy's in his 90s now. Strong support for the Cuban Revolution and the kind of treatment that he got, and why he says he believed in that cause. It sort of swept him away. You know, he was approached by Castro because he was a man who sold firearms. It's what his father did here in Mexico City. And Castro said, I need to get some good weapons, you know.
And then
the man sold him some Austrian weapons, I think. So that's how their friendship began. But it lasted, and it became this this friendship. And he could talk to you about what Fidel Castro was like as a human being, you know.
Mm.
And you get some glimpses there that aren't very commonly seen outside, you know, outside of this relationship.
Any secrets that you learned in terms of getting insight into Fidel's character, personality, you know, the person?
I don't know if I learned any deep secrets. We did get the sense that, you know, I never saw or met Fidel Castro in person. I was at one event that Fidel Castro attended famously in Mexico back in the days when Vicente Fox was president. Mm. I was covering this international summit of Latin American leaders. They were gathered in Mexico, and Fox famously told Fidel Castro, come have dinner and then get out of here. Leave. You know, cenas y te vas. And that message was actually recorded. A telephone interview was recorded, and it went out to the world. I'm sure it was somebody in Cuba. that might give you a bit of an inkling of, you know, of what Castro was like.
Of what Vicente Fox was like, too, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. Castro, because of what he did, he's the one who basically said put the audio out there. He didn't make a big fit about it. He just basically said, such treatment for a president, you know,
right, he was the president role too,
of Cuba. And I think after a while, yeah, he didn't stay for that summit. So toward his later years, yeah, a measured man, right? But I think everybody that I spoke with, including this elderly gentleman, El Cuate, gave the sense of, you know, an amazingly charismatic and very brilliant man, Fidel Castro. Quite an able lawyer. That, of course, is what he was before all of his revolutionary days, a lawyer.
That's right.
And well-studied, a man who read and kind of never stopped questioning and wondering and you know, learning. And these were the kind of things that we got from this elderly man, El Cuate.
And it's interesting to look around Latin America and the Caribbean now and ponder what the impact of Castro and the Cuban Revolution has been. If you go back to the encouragement of the left, for example, in Chile up to September 11th, 1973, with the killing of Allende, looking at the relationship that developed between Venezuela and Cuba, the development of regional structures that are now, you know, CELAC and Mercosur and UNASUR even, that are, you know, really embryonic. The development of those was, you know, Castro, Hugo Chavez, and a couple of other people starting to forge ties among the members of the Latin American community.
Well, I think you could really see it physically on the day that global leaders gathered in the Plaza of the Revolution in Havana before they made that long journey to Santiago for the burial. And it was a number of world leaders who spoke about their relationship with Cuba and with Fidel Castro. And, of course, among those were all the leaders of the nations you just mentioned. It was very interesting to me to see that Raul Castro, on 2 days that he spoke in giant public plazas in the country, at his side was Nicolas Maduro, who is the president of Venezuela.
Yep.
And so he was there. You also saw Daniel Ortega.
That's right.
Who just won re-election as Nicaragua's president. He, as you know, is the leader of the Sandinista revolution. So, you know, that's there. And you saw Evo Morales speaking, as you pointed out in a recent broadcast. And leaders from all over the world. China's vice president was there.
Right.
Top leaders of the Islamic Republic of Iran were there.
Yep. To me, one of the things that caught my eye was Alexis Tsipras, the Prime Minister of Greece, which has been sort of locked in a fight with neoliberalism, you know, since the election of Syriza and perhaps even before, and also Jacob Zuma, who, for all his flaws, was compelled to go there because of the debt that the people of South Africa acknowledge, that was articulated many times by Nelson Mandela, to the Cuban people, the Cuban Revolution, and Fidel Castro.
Absolutely. And we watched the speeches from that broadcast station that you were talking about, a place called Eurovision,
right,
in Havana. And sitting next to us was a group of journalists from South Africa. They'd
right.
crossed, you know, traveled from that part of the world to Cuba to cover this. And I noticed that there were a good number of African broadcasting networks that were in Cuba to cover Zuma's speech and to basically cover the entire process as we did. So it made me think that there are a lot of friends of Cuba in Africa, for example, you know, so sure. so not just in the region here in Latin America. And, you know, I think a lot of people are willing to say, yeah, there were problems. But a lot of people will say this man will be remembered forever.
Yeah, agreed. You know, back to what's going on, the changes that are going on the ground in Cuba. Another area that you covered was the increasing Wi-Fi coverage. And I had some experience, actually, until we came over to your station where there was Wi-Fi in the hotel. There was some difficulty getting it, but it's increased immensely, Cubans told us, over what they had. And so this is something that's really rolling out now.
That's right. It's all coming from the Cuban state-run telecoms company there. And basically what we saw was something that I thought was quite unusual. We travel around Latin America, Mexico and Latin America quite a bit. The kind of internet experience you usually have is very similar to what you get in New York. You yeah. you basically get 3G, 4G, Wi-Fi, right? If you're at a right. if you're at a coffee shop or something.
Right.
But you can get all these services pretty much in all of the capitals. In Havana, it was a bit different. People would go to specific hotspots
right.
and you'd pay for a card and then get service there and basically sit at the hotspot. So you'd see people with laptops out sitting on street corners or at bus stop areas or different locations. One of the most interesting right. ones was in a residential area of Havana. We saw a really nice park, strolled into the park, and there were about 20, 30 people in the park having chats with family members outside of Cuba, absolutely open, you know, talking about how the day is going, what people were feeling about the funeral services and things like that. And it was interesting to see that. It made me think that that's quite an opening, isn't it, to have that
sure.
kind of access. I did notice that you cannot do Skype in Cuba.
Yeah,
that's not allowed.
It doesn't work.
Yeah, it's not enabled there. But people were on chats and they were doing video chats and things like that and checking websites and I thought that was quite fascinating. It is part of this opening that is taking place there.
And another aspect to this opening is the increase in tourism, that it's a main driver of the economy. And you probed that some, too.
Yeah, we decided to put on our tourist clothes one day and jump in one of those old vehicles and drive around a little bit and then ask some people who were in the tourist area called La Havana Vieja, that's Old Havana, ask them how was the death of Fidel Castro's affecting their experience? Is it creating difficulties, or how do they view it? And we ran into a small group of tourists that were from the United States, actually, and some of them were actually from my hometown, Tucson.
Uh-huh. Wow.
And they were there on a tour of how to learn to shoot photographs in the streets of Havana, following a well-known U.S. photographer around the city. And they basically told us that the death of Fidel Castro really enhanced their experience because they were able to enjoy the tourism experience in Old Havana.
Right.
But also, if they wanted to, they could go to the Plaza of the Revolution and take photos of those people streaming into the monument to pay their respects in the area there where Fidel Castro's photograph was set. And so they saw it sort of as quite an unexpected sort of, they didn't want to say it this way, but kind of a plus.
Right, a value add.
Not because he was gone, but because of the historic moment that it represented for that country, you know,
right,
to
right.
be there and witness people's responses to it. And the tourism sector, the tourism parts of the city that we visited are just absolutely lovely. I hope that the capitalist president of the United States president-elect will not change the flights and allow tourists to continue to go. It's just going to be good for the Cuban economy and good for Americans to see that. And it's just a wonderful experience from what I could see.
Yeah, well, part of my experience was Errol Maitland wanted to videotape sunrise from the beach. So we went out to the beach, and when we got there before sunrise and it's still dark, he said, let's go in the water. And I thought we'd freeze. And I went in the water. It was warm. It was like getting a big hug. And then we sat and watched the sunrise for like the next 45 minutes to an hour. It's beautiful. And that's an experience people should have if they can.
Yeah, I'd like to have that experience. Sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
I got the sense that it's a country I would definitely like to go back to see. And this time I think I'll leave the microphones behind.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you brought them. You also spoke with some fishermen about the country's future and a little bit about some of what they do as a fisherman.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about the background of that assignment. We were told that we needed to go do a story about Cuban millennials. So, of course, I'm going, okay, what's a millennial again? So I'm looking at the definition. It's a wide-ranging definition. We decided to call it anyone from 20 to 34, 35-ish, something like
cool.
That.
Yeah, yeah.
So we were going to go look for young Cubans and ask them. I did not want them to denounce their government. I was not looking for them to speak badly about the country. I just wanted to ask them, as a young person, what would you like to see for your country,
Yeah.
And I should tell you, we had a difficult time filming that story. For some reason, that question, people didn't really want to engage with us on that. And I think it was partly because there might be a perception that we were a foreign news agency, and sometimes foreign news agencies oftentimes have taken statements out of context, and people, there becomes this confusion about what people really think. So we had a number of young people tell us that they really didn't want to talk to us on camera.
Wow.
One group of young people told us on that day they preferred to watch a soccer match between Real Madrid, and they were wearing the Real Madrid jerseys, and against Barcelona, rather than watching the official channel, which was broadcasting the funeral services. They didn't want to see that.
Right.
So we decided to go down the coast a little bit to a town where I actually met you and Earl,
right,
at Cojimar, which is the famous location where Ernest Hemingway, right, the famous author, got his inspiration for The Old Man and the Sea.
Right. Yep.
So what we wanted to do was actually take a little bit of a twist of that and go talk to young men, Cuban young men, who are still making their living from the sea. Mm. And we did talk to a number of people who go out in these tiny fishing boats. We saw that the fishing boats were actually made by carpenters there.
Right.
They don't have GPS. They don't have sonar,
right,
anything like that. They go out to the high seas, and basically fish. They look for marlin. And sometimes it's fishing all night, and sometimes you're pulling in a line with, a marlin that's quite large, larger than an adult man, and more powerful
than the boat.
And fighting this thing at sea and trying to haul it in. And I got images of that amazing novel, Old Man in the Sea. Reread it when you can. It's a beautiful novel,
Yeah.
And you could see where he got this inspiration. The young man told us very matter-of-factly that the fishing station that they were based at there in Cojimar used to be run by the government. It's now entirely privatized. They created a collective and started their own businesses there. And a lot of them said they were very happy with their lifestyle. They didn't make a lot of money, but it was a good lifestyle. One said that he would like to make more money so he could buy a GPS and,
right, exactly,
and do more fishing,
Yeah.
So
we'll play that clip here. That was cute. I like that.
Maybe I'll never have a millionaire's yacht, but it would be good to have a boat with GPS and sonar to help us fish without the fear of running into something that damages our vessel or that the motor fails. Maybe that's asking too much. But in the rest of the world, all boats have these things.
That was great.
Yeah, it was really good to meet these guys in this location for me. That's such an important, famous place. And I'm told that Hemingway was also a very good friend of Fidel Castro.
Oh, that's interesting too, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hey, I got to thank you, Frank. It was a pleasure meeting you and hanging out with you and speaking with you this time. And I hope we get to do it again a lot.
You guys can always count on me. I'm a big fan, and it's really great to be on the program here. Thanks so much, and great to meet you, Don.